somebody with a tumor when that's causing them to have pain, if I can't cut the tumor out or shrink the tumor with chemotherapy or radiation, can I give you a medication that will simply change the way your body feels the tumor?
Welcome to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Mark Bonta, a podcast that examines health issues with a critical eye grounded in scientific skepticism. Disclaimer. The Ditch the Lab Coat podcast is no different than sitting in on a conversation between healthcare professionals at a cocktail party. It is intended to be a fun and informative listening experience that gives all of our listeners a chance to make sense of the fascinating world of medicine. It is a podcast. It is not a substitute for professional medical services, does not establish a doctor-patient relationship, and the use of the information from the podcast or linked materials is at the user's own risk. Basically, if you have a headache that just won't go away, or if your fingers are turning blue and falling off, go to your local emergency department, urgent care center, or see your primary care doctor or nurse practitioner. The content does not aim to replace professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. The expressed opinions belong solely to the hosts and guests, and they do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the hospitals, clinics, universities, or any other organization associated with them. So plug in, enjoy, and get ready to expand your knowledge of all things medical by listening to our fun, evidence-based, and practical conversations. But if your hair falls out after listening to the show, go see a medical professional and don't file a lawsuit against me or my guests. All righty, Ditch the Lab Coat podcast enthusiasts. Let's get ready to unravel the mysteries of medicine in a way that's both enlightening and accessible to all. I'm thrilled to be your host, and today's guest needs no introduction in the realm of healthcare, particularly in palliative care medicine. It's the remarkable Dr. James Downer. Dr. James Downer's expertise is as vast as it is impressive. As the head and professor of palliative care at the University of Ottawa, he's at the forefront of shaping compassionate end-of-life care, but his contributions don't stop there. He also holds the prestigious title of Clinical Research Chair in Palliative and End-of-Life Care, showcasing his dedication to advancing our understanding of palliative medicine. In addition to his academic roles, Dr. Downer is a critical care physician at the Ottawa Hospital, where he navigates the complexities of critical care with unwavering expertise. And let's not forget his role as an investigator at the Briere Research Institute, where he tirelessly explores new frontiers in healthcare research. Dr. Downer's journey to excellence began at McGill Medical School, where he laid the foundation for his illustrious career. Following that, he pursued residency training at the University of Toronto, where he also earned a master's degree in bioethics, demonstrating his commitment to ethical healthcare practices. But beyond his impressive credentials lies a passion for research that is truly inspiring. Dr. Downer's specific research interests include communication, decision-making, and suffering in seriously ill patients, as well as bereavement and complicated grief. He's also deeply invested in palliative care for both the critically ill and those facing non-cancer illnesses. And today, folks, we're in for a treat. In our conversation with Dr. Downer, we'll be diving into some thought-provoking topics, including what it's like to witness someone's passing, the realities of how people actually die, personal preparations for the inevitable end, the potential role of psychedelics in facing death, and unraveling the complexities of medical assistance in dying. So grab your headphones, AirPods, earbuds, and get ready to embark on a journey of discovery with Dr. James Downer. So I think I wanted to start, James, by asking, everyone has this hope that they will die in their sleep. You know, one day when I'm 95, I'm going to go to bed and not wake up. And that's right. This peaceful, die in your sleep. Does that happen?
It can happen. There are definitely people who die, and taking it more broadly, I think there's obviously the idealized, you know, dying peacefully in your sleep, having never been sick a day in your life, in your mid-90s, surrounded by beloved family members in the home you've lived in forever. I think it's a mathematical possibility that that will happen, but not, I would say, likely. I would suggest that most people have to prepare a plan B. Most people do spend a considerable portion of their lives, particularly the final months and years of their life, interacting with healthcare providers, getting admitted to hospital, and getting treated for illnesses that have predictable courses. Some people can be managed at home and die peacefully at home. Some people more or less peacefully at home. Some people just have needs that cannot be met in a home environment, even with community supports, and they have to go to an inpatient facility to get the kind of support that they would need. I think everybody's, there's sort of a spectrum of different experiences, and it can be a little bit unpredictable. So even if ultimately you don't need those services and you are able to die at home peacefully, most people have to plan for the possibility that that won't happen.
What does that planning mean? Like what you're saying is dying in your sleep, that fantasy is possible, but not probable. So you're likely to experience a kind of slow and steady stepwise deterioration, perhaps loss of function, capacity. So how do you prepare, you know, write a will?
Well, it's inconsistent, right? So there are classically four dying trajectories that have been described. There's the sudden death, you know, traumatic or homicide deaths where somebody is in, you know, excellent health and just dies suddenly. That's very rare in North America. That's like kind of the 5% range. And then the remainder, sort of 95%+, are split between one of three kind of trajectories. You have your terminal illness trajectory where somebody's doing fairly well until they reach an advanced point in their illness and they start to decline. And their decline is sort of accelerating, relentless, and it just kind of keeps going quite quickly. The classic examples of that would be metastatic cancer, for example, that's not necessarily amenable to treatments. ALS would be another condition that might progress that way. In contrast to cancer, there are conditions like organ failure, heart failure, or chronic respiratory disease, where people have a sort of a deteriorating course, but with lots of exacerbations and recoveries. So people get a sudden drop and then they recover and then another drop and then a recovery and then all recovering to a baseline that's slowly declining. And then one of these sudden deteriorations ends up being a terminal deterioration from which you don't recover, but it's hard sometimes to tell which one that is. You have a trajectory known as frailty, where people do kind of fairly slowly start to deteriorate over time. They don't have one main illness, but they may have a variety of different conditions where someone is just slowly losing function, slowly losing their abilities and needing more and more help with everything. But no big sudden changes, just a fairly slow and steady decline over a much longer period of time. And so those are the kinds of things you want to prepare for. And depending on which one of those paths you're on, your planning might look a little different. So people with advanced cancer, for example, ALS, they've got a fairly predictable time course. They are sort of confronted by the fact that they have a defined, identifiable illness that they can often plan around what those deteriorations will look like and the time course. They can align services. Services are pretty well set up for that trajectory. It fits more nicely into our system of home care and end-of-life units. For the sort of exacerbation recovery conditions like organ failure, that's a little different. So there can be much more challenging to prognosticate for people. People, again, it's hard sometimes to tell, except in retrospect, whether a deterioration is the final deterioration or just one of many episodes from which you'll recover. And many people are quite interested in trying to prolong their life if they can recover to perhaps their baseline that they were at before. But sometimes hard to counsel people around that because the deterioration can be rapid and, you know, the recovery is a bit unpredictable. So those individuals don't necessarily fit neatly into the model of care that was created around cancer, which we still use for most of our end-of-life services and home care services. And then finally, the frailty, where people sometimes don't even have a defined illness. They kind of have mild to moderate everything. And sometimes people would look at somebody with frailty conditions and they wouldn't even consider them to be medical conditions. They'd sort of, sometimes people would just call that sort of conditions of aging and not even necessarily recognize those as medical conditions or pathology that will get worse over time. And so that's why trying to plan around that becomes even more challenging. Again, it does not fit into like prognostication. People with frailty conditions can live fairly stably for years, or they can get a sudden illness like influenza or COVID and die very quickly. They can live independently for a long time, or they'll fall and break their hip. And then there's a very, very high risk of death in the coming months after that and certainly functional decline. But those are often random events, hard to plan around sometimes. You know, you might know what might happen, but not necessarily when it's going to happen. So that becomes a bit challenging.
You know, those people who have those chronic diseases that flare, like multi-system or end organ disease, like right away in my mind, I'm thinking about people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. So they get exacerbations of their breathing, they get hospitalized, they need some oxygen, or people who have liver disease or cirrhosis, and then they get acutely ill. They might get encephalopathic or confused. They have an infection, a bleed. And so patients will come in very sick, and then sometimes within a day or two, they're back to baseline, right? Maybe their baseline's a little bit off, but the healthcare providers sometimes behind closed doors will make analogies or comparisons to cats, nine lives.
And yep.
Eventually, one of those lives is going to be the terminal one, right? Like you can't have end liver disease or kidney disease and keep having infections or bleeds or whatever and live forever. But a lot of those chronic conditions are associated with substance use, you know, ranging from alcohol, recreational drugs, injection drugs, smoking. Where would you put substance use disorders into that trajectory of dying? Because those people can die from all of those things.
You're asking a really interesting question. Take a step back. One of the questions that you ask yourself, because there's a complex interrelationship between chronic illness and risk of premature death and social determinants of health and addiction and substance use disorders. So they all ride together. If you have chronic illness, you are more likely to have lower socioeconomic status. If you have lower socioeconomic status, you are more likely to have substance use disorder, certain kinds of substance use disorder. There are socioethnic groups and people with structural and social deprivation who are at greater risk of substance use disorder. Not every group, you can't put them all in the same bucket, but there is definitely a measured risk for many groups. So that relationship between chronic illness, socioeconomic status, substance use disorder, et cetera, what's the driver, right? So which one of those starts the cycle, less clear sometimes, versus which one is the result of something else? I think there's a fairly decent amount of data around there now suggesting that socioeconomic and certainly financial deprivation is a pretty hefty driver of a lot of madness. And so I think those are key factors. I think that we're starting perhaps to understand a little bit more about how substance use disorder might be better treated and how that relates to not so much people getting their hands on illicit drugs, but actually diverted drugs or people who are stockpiling prescribed drugs and diverting prescribed drugs and then using those. We've got sort of just not yet published research, but suggesting that a fairly large proportion of people who died of an overdose in Ontario in the past 5 years actually was being followed by a palliative care provider. So it's not one of these things where there's a neat line between substance use disorder overdose and the harms that come from substance use disorder with chronic illness and our attempts to treat chronic illness and palliate people properly. It's not as neat as maybe we might hope it would be.
So you work in intensive care units and you're a palliative care medicine provider. Both of those fields have a lot of intersection with death, right? When you go to an ICU, you're really sick. You're either going to survive or die. Obviously, if you're receiving palliative care, it's because that end is near. So you've probably seen a lot of death, more than a dermatologist or a psychiatrist, some of these other clinical professions that don't really interact with the end of life. How many people that you care for or treat who die stick with you?
Well, it's a great question. For patients that I treat in the ICU, I'm happy to say that not many of them stick with me for very long. They usually recover and they get out of there, and that's great. Well, I'd like to think that what we do in the critical care unit is often quite effective, not just for prolonging life, but helping bridge people to recovery. There are predictable situations where that's not happening, where the critical illness is just part of a bigger trajectory or a much more obvious trajectory of a chronic illness or an incurable illness getting worse. And those are tough, right? Sometimes people come in the ICU and they weren't ready for this deterioration, and you have to have quite a difficult conversation, either at a crisis or these individuals end up on life-sustaining measures, with a tube, and you're talking to family members having to make really heartbreaking decisions on behalf of a person who now is no longer able to participate in those conversations. That's tough. In palliative care, say the large majority of patients we see are probably going to die in the coming weeks or months. That's not everybody, but most people. And that data tends to show that for palliative care. We try to integrate palliative approaches earlier in care, but for specialists, our specialist level involvement tends to be closer to the end of life than, and it still is. But every now and again, you do get an individual who, you know, you get consulted to help, who's still receiving treatment with curative intent. And that's really nice when that happens, right? You get these people that, you know, you manage their symptoms, you make them feel better. They actually respond nicely to the treatments, they recover and they go home. And then you'll see them, you know, long time later, and they look great. And that's really nice when you do see that. Sometimes we get patients and family members come back to the ICU after they've been there a while. And boy, does that feel good. You know, it really gives you a reminder that, you know, that what you're there for, you know, to what you're trying to help people achieve, which can be very, very nice. And I've got, you know, some people I follow, particularly non-cancer patients, who some of whom I've been following for a year and a half. And I had a very sort of heartbreaking conversation with individuals about the difficult decisions that I thought were likely to come in the next few months. And lo and behold, we made some minor medication adjustments. The person felt dramatically better, much more so than I think anyone might have predicted. And that really, they actually probably have a lot longer than we had anticipated. And they've started to travel and they're having fun and just really enjoying a high quality of life. And boy, it's really lovely when you can see that.
So I'm going to get meta on you.
Go.
How many people stay with you? So you've talked about the people who survive the ICU and actually survive a terminal diagnosis or perhaps recover, respond to treatment in ways you might have not predicted. How many of these people that pass away, right, with your ongoing care and support stick with you? You know, if somebody's working in an assembly line at an auto factory, I don't think they come home and think about the headlights they put into a car or the tires. How many of those patients that you become a part of their life with their family, with everything, you obviously can't take everybody home. What percentage do you actually go home and maybe have a think about, or they come into your consciousness on the weekend when you're out with your family? Like, how often does that happen?
Yeah, I mean, what a great question. I think that certainly earlier in my career, I had a much more regular follow-up with patients, not just those from critical care environment, but those also from the palliative care setting who recovered and got better. And, you know, I do have a kind of raft of thank you cards and things from people. It's not, I think that people like cardiologists and nephrologists and respirologists probably get a lot more because they have patients who they follow for years. They get quite a relationship with, and Christmas time for those docs, man, they get piles of presents and more booze than anyone could drink in a year. But that doesn't happen, I think, in palliative care. But when you see people and you help people get through a rough patch, they remember you and they'll say, like, I had one patient who I saw managed for in the ICU for about 3 months, and he managed to get to a transplant and get home with his wife. And we had no reason to think he was going to make it, but we were trying our best to help him pull through. Not only pull through, but he managed to get home and get healthy. And he and his wife had a kid. They were sending us all these photos and stuff of them and how well they get on. Those patients stay with me a long time. I think there are also times when you remember, obviously, the worst outcomes where, you know, and I think for all of us, it's a different group that maybe pulls on your heartstrings a bit more. There's a sort of, we all have our kryptonite in terms of what situation. I think for me, people with small kids, I've often found that much more emotionally challenging. And I remember very much those moments where I have to explain to a small child what's happening to their parent. That's very tough. And that stays with you a lot. And you bring that home with you. I think maybe with time, we get a little bit better at compartmentalizing that a bit. Maybe you get more sort of serene and accepting of what you can and can't do, and a little less frustrated by the limitations. And part of that, I think, involves a bit of a selective vision and hearing, where you're maybe a bit better at focusing on what you are good at and capable of doing, and less frustrated by the things you can't.
How do you break bad news to a child?
Oh, gosh. I mean, there's obviously textbooks on it. There's a lot that I probably can't do justice to here, but you know, a lot of it is just making sure that they're supported and making sure that you're trying to be, depending on, it's also very age specific, right? But if it's an older child, somebody who's, you'd be surprised at how mature some kids can be around this stuff. And I think the old days used to be very much the philosophy that you should don't tell children, kind of keep them in the dark. They were told platitudes like, you know, we have to pray for them, we have to do this for them, you know, we'll get them through, and try to shield them from any negative news. With experience, I think the recurrent feeling is that that's probably not the best thing to do. Actually, sometimes your attempts to protect people are more harmful than beneficial on the whole, and that maybe just being a bit honest with people, being frank with them, but being, you know, supportive, make sure that you create a space where they can ask questions. Children have different fears and different informational needs than adults do sometimes, but they're also much more literal about things sometimes. And so they have powerful imaginations. And so sometimes children get stuck on, you know, did they cause the illness with something that they did? You know, they step on the crack, break your mother's back thing. They're sometimes fearful that they'll catch it, that it's contagious, and that something they can do will cure it. So, you know, when a loved one ultimately dies, do they feel guilty that they didn't pray hard enough or that they weren't a good enough person? That's the stuff you have to really make sure you guard against. And there are obviously experts in this, and people in pediatrics, social workers, some children's grief counselors, just excellent people I've worked with over the years who are just magical at this stuff.
So have there been any large studies that have disproven that stepping on a crack will break one's mother's back?
No, I would have to look into that.
Not in the New England Journal of Medicine?
Not that I'm aware of. I must say there are limits to even my knowledge, Mark. You're kind of catching me out a little bit. I wish you'd given me more prep time on this.
Well, if you kind of look at some of these relationships that you have, they're not that longitudinal, right? If you're a palliative care physician. So I guess what you take out of that, or the gift you get, is being a part of their care and supporting them towards the end of life and being a part of their existence and family and easing suffering. But you're not getting gifts. But you commented on cardiologists and nephrologists. And I just wanted to say, I think heart surgeons get by far the most gifts.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. Again, not sort of grade A evidence on that front, but I think it speaks to the relationships that people form with their doctors and relationships between doctors and patients, right? Like, you can't always have that sort of long-term investment with people. And surgeons are often in a very privileged position where they kind of engage in a really intense project with somebody, and you work really hard, and they sort of slave away in the operating room to get something done. And then they feel both emotionally and personally invested that they're going to fight hard to get that person and help that person get better. And it's not surprising that, you know, surgeons will be viewed at, like, this person literally had someone's life in their hands. And if they pull through, it's hard to argue that they weren't the reason that happened, right? And so from that forms a very strong relationship. And boy, if you're a surgeon, the ones who recover, get better, and come back and see you every year, your clinic ends up being full of people that you fixed. And so I can imagine that that's quite a fun experience, this sort of parade of grateful people swinging through your office just to show you pictures of their grandkids and all that other stuff, which I think is very gratifying as a physician. I don't begrudge them that.
Then there's this other secret clinic they don't tell you about where it's all the people they left sponges in who come to see them and give them patient complaints. Now, when you talk about, like, the end of life and someone making that transition, many people at the end of life are fortunate to have family and friends close with them to be a part of that journey. So it's not just a provider-patient relationship, but it's a provider-family relationship. And there's a lot of buzz in North American and European news about kind of helping families cope with that. And there are studies being done whereby patients and families are given psychedelics and ecstasy and things like that. Is that something that's a part of counseling and palliative care support for families in Canada? Is that something that shows promise, or is it just kind of hodgepodge?
It's a great question. I mean, let's take a step back and look at our ability to treat psychological distress and psychological symptoms in general. I think that, you know, we have to be honest about what we are good at and what maybe where we have a lot of room that we need to improve. I think it's true that there are challenges in terms of access to services. And that's obviously something we need to improve, is access to high quality services. We also have to recognize, though, that there are many types of distress and suffering that we actually haven't figured out how to treat yet, or that our ability, the effectiveness of what we're using is modest. I wouldn't say useless, quite the contrary. I would say definitely shows utility in studies. But when you get into the context of discussions around, you know, refractory illness, assisted dying, what do you do for refractory mental illness? There's a lot of refractory mental illness out there. It's a very common condition, and again, often spontaneously improves, but sometimes it doesn't. And so that's where a lot of this discussion comes from. It's obviously a political and fraught discussion. But I think it's not appropriate to simply dismiss this and say that it doesn't happen. At the same time, you know, when it comes to things like complicated grief, there are proven therapies for complicated grief. But again, some of the interventions, like just our literature around treatment of grief and grief symptoms, the literature isn't full of positive studies with lots of effectiveness. There are definitely limitations. There are definitely things where we have big room to improve. So when someone starts to publish studies around the use of psychedelic therapies, right? And you see some of these remarkable improvements that have been reported, albeit in uncontrolled studies sometimes, you can understand that there's an appropriately high level of enthusiasm about that, because this is a gap that needs closing. And it's not an access gap. It's a capabilities gap. It's an effectiveness gap. I think that the excitement around psychedelic therapy is appropriate. But we have to be cautious. We can't, this will not be the panacea for sure. There are a lot of people who can't take them for a lot of reasons. It does require, like the protocols that people use, it's not just people dropping acid and sitting in a chair for 4 hours. There's a lot that goes into preparation and the session itself and then integration afterwards. And so there is that aspect of feasibility and resource intensity as well. I can tell you that in Ottawa, we've embarked on a number of research programs to try to look into existential distress and psychological distress among people with advanced illness, because that's another area where, looking specifically at people with advanced and terminal illnesses, where the evidence for things like medications and psychotherapy are, it's sometimes modest, right? Like the effectiveness, it's far from a cure, what we have. And the durability of the effect is not always very long. And thus, it's important to make sure those things are on offer. But while we're improving access, we also have to look at new ways to treat that. So we've done a study looking at something called repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation, RTMS, which has shown some pretty promising results in the palliative setting. It's been used for decades in the psychiatric world and has been shown to be pretty effective, even for refractory depression. So very promising therapy. But again, it's not a universal cure, but it does work very well a lot of the time. So that's a great new opportunity. Hopefully psychedelics, are we talking about macro dosing, the high dose psychedelics? Do you talk about more like daily or regular micro dosing? Many people report that to be very effective. We don't have data on it. We've got a study right now looking at micro dosing of psychedelics among people with incurable advanced illnesses. So we've got a big gap to fill, I think, in terms of our armamentarium to treat this. But yeah, I think people listening to this, I don't want to be doom and gloom here. There's some promising stuff out there. And again, it's not appropriate to talk about curing this in all people. But considering how common this condition is, these conditions, I should say, are, how many people are affected by it and how severe it can be, I'm cautiously optimistic that we might be able to make a real dent in this type of suffering for people in the near future.
We got to shift some attention away from the heart. I think we know so much about the heart and cardiologists and all these new drugs come out all the time, but the mind is fascinating. And a lot of the treatments that we have, like when you're talking about, you know, magnetic stimulation and electroconvulsive therapies, and even some of these psychedelics, like we don't know what they're doing or how exactly they work, but they seem to help. So it's just like throw anything at it. But hopefully ChatGPT can help us figure out the brain a little bit more.
No, I mean, I think the issue, right, is that, you know, when you look at palliative care, what is palliative care? On a very basic level, if I've got somebody with a tumor when that's causing them to have pain, if I can't cut the tumor out or shrink the tumor with chemotherapy or radiation, can I give you a medication that will simply change the way your body feels the tumor? That's analgesia, right? So I'm affecting neuronal signaling, essentially pain signaling around this. I think when you look at how the brain works, where we are actually understanding better and better all the time, the functioning of neural networks and the importance of how aspects of communication between the frontal lobes that try to come up with plans of how to meet needs, the temporal lobes that encode meaning and purpose, and parietal lobes, the understanding of what's available to you and what's around you. There seem to be really a lot of networks that are key networks that are related to suffering and different types of suffering, depression, mood disorders, existential distress. Those networks, we actually have identified them, and it does seem like a lot of these therapies do impact on the functioning of these areas of the brain, and with the resultant, hopefully beneficial effects on how people look at their reality, right? Like that's the challenge of depression. Depression isn't a condition caused by the fact that your life is terrible. Depression is a condition caused by the fact that you have difficulty perhaps seeing the positive and maybe are more focused on the negative, for example. But it's not about what is happening to your life. It's about your perception of what's happening to you and your life. And the same is true of many mental disorders, which is helpfully gives us some insight in how we can better treat them, whether that's with medication or with magnetic therapies, psychedelics, these are all various, you know, psychotherapies. These are all different ways of helping people change the way that they look at their reality with varying degrees of effectiveness.
So obviously palliative medicine or palliative care medicine isn't as straightforward as helping someone with a tumor in their brain die without suffering, but it's complicated. It's helping families. It's helping to deal with that amount of grief that they're experiencing. I'm sure there's a lot of ups and downs that patients experience. And as you described, the trajectories to death are very broad. How long has palliative care medicine been a thing? Is this a new thing or has it been around for a long time?
Well, yeah, so it's a good question. Modern palliative care is sort of traced back to, the term itself was coined in 1974 by a Canadian, Dr. Balfour Mount, who was a urologist working at McGill, founded a palliative care unit there. But sort of the grandmother, I guess, of the modern palliative care movement is Dame Cicely Saunders, who started up St. Christopher's Hospice in London, sort of after experiences when she went through multiple iterations in different professions, eventually becoming a physician, but always very interested in more holistic views of illness and wellness and symptom management, which at the time was really quite radical in the medical world, where the emphasis had always been on just cure, cure, cure. And, you know, if somebody's dying, you don't tell them. The idea of patient autonomy and patient agency was kind of not a thing. The idea that you might forego quantity of life in the interest of quality was sort of less overtly accepted. And so from there has spurned this entire palliative care field, but also movement around the world where people have, it's become a sort of socio-medical concept where it isn't just a training, like people can receive training, but there's also, you know, people who work in this as professionals, as volunteers, as fundraising. It's, again, something that builds in many ways out of the community. Before the modern palliative care movement, of course, there was a lot of people who looked at the same concepts and sort of arriving at the same conclusions, right? So that to cure sometimes, to care always, right? And this kind of concept that we need to always make sure that we're caring for people and attending to their needs, even if cure is no longer possible. And of course, religious organizations going back centuries in the old hospices and the concept of the hospice as a place where people go for compassionate care when they may be a hopeless case. So the concepts that we talk about in palliative care are not, date back well before the modern palliative care movement. But I think what you see now is much more akin to a medical field with a social kind of construct around it, which has obviously become very important to a lot of people.
So working in your career, as I think all of us in healthcare and thinking about first responders and nurses and everybody who interacts with patients, we've all seen a lot of people die. I've directly watched people die many, many times. And that could range from people who were, you know, slowly nearing the end of their lives, and then you're called to the bedside because they're having breathing difficulties and you're supporting the patients and the families, to people who have a cardiac arrest and you just can't bring them back, to people who are on ventilators who wish to be organ donors and then wish to be have their care withdrawn and have a cardiac death whereby you need to observe their heart stopping, essentially, to deem them ready to donate their organs. So there's lots of different spectrums of death, and we've all seen a lot of people die. And I remember when I was a medical student, there was a patient who was receiving palliative care. They had some end organ disease and their time was close, right? The resident said, "Mark, you know, come in the room. It's a good chance to learn. This person's dying." I had no idea how they knew that, like if they got a memo or an email, but they said, "This person's dying, so come in the room." So I went in the room. When I got there, the person had actually passed away. And so the resident showed me how you would pronounce a patient dead. You need to show that they're not breathing, that they don't have heart sounds. There's actually an approach to this. And then we were there with the patient's family, and I started tripping out, because I was looking at the patient's neck and it looked like the veins were still fluttering. And in my mind, I was like, "Oh my gosh, this person's not dead." And they just said, "He's dead and he's not dead and he's alive." And I didn't know what to do. And I was in this whole, like, the hierarchy of, I don't want to tell my resident or my staff doctor. And like, maybe I'm seeing things, like, what's wrong with me? And then obviously that movement stopped. But then afterwards, I spoke to the resident. I said, like, "Are you sure the person was dead?" And he was explaining that, like, you know, as pressures and everything change within the human body, you might see this like distribution of fluids. And sometimes there can be noises and sometimes there can be changes. And that fluttering you were seeing is a normal thing. But I wasn't prepared for that. And thank goodness the family was stepping back a few feet, because I couldn't imagine being a part of that family and saying, "The doctors just said my dad's dead, but he's moving. right? Or he's making a sound. And so what I've made as a part of my practice is counseling family members on what to expect or what to expect as someone approaches the end of the life. So if you're with a patient's family and you know that they're actively dying, and I think by this point in our training and careers, we're pretty good at detecting that. What are some of the things you let the family know to prepare for seeing so that they don't freak out like poor Mark, the medical student?
I think you're touching on some important concepts here. Is that the number one thing to do is I think with family members who may be not familiar with the death and dying process is just, I think, speaking to somebody in a calm and measured tone. The behavior of the physician, the nurse in the room, and any other allied health, of course, but I would say physician and nurse in the room, actually is very important, I think, to how the family member will remember that event. When people have PTSD from an experience, it's often from a sense of helplessness or watching something that is really awful that they don't feel like they have any control over. So if you're in the room and shouting and yelling and you yourself are quite agitated and animated, that can contribute to an environment that will be traumatic to a family member. I think if you are calm and measured and sort of explaining things in a calm way, I think that's a key part of it. Then in terms of what you actually explain, you do need to try to anticipate what people might see. So in some cases, it may be simply just people slowly, you know, having irregular breathing patterns, deep breathing, alternating with periods where they're not breathing at all. And that's sometimes hard to tell, is this person died? And I remember when I was a teenager, my grandfather dying and watching him die, very clearly I can recall what was, you know, Shane Stokes breathing, this sort of, you know, irregular pattern, you know, sped up, deeper breathing, alternating with slower, less frequent and shallow breaths, and in fact, periods where he wasn't breathing at all. And, you know, I remember very clearly as I was sitting there, I was by myself, I was 17. And whenever this happened, I would kind of shake him and call his name. And then, of course, within 5 seconds, he would start breathing again and deep breathing. And I had convinced myself that I had basically, you know, brought him back to life 4, 5, 6, 7 times. You know, like it just, in retrospect, obviously, his changing breathing pattern had nothing to do with me. But when you're a family member and you don't know that at the bedside, it's very easy to convince yourself that there's something that is related to your own actions as an individual. And so, you know, just making sure that they understand like irregular breathing patterns, changes in color, that they might see symptoms, they might look like they're starting to breathe a little harder. If that happens, we give medications. There's also some situations where you can, you know, you mentioned people with cirrhosis, and sometimes people with cirrhosis can get quite severe bleeds and they can bleed at the time of their death. And those can be quite distressing for family members to witness if you haven't seen it before, people coughing up blood. It can be really, that's not something that you see every day. So the idea that preparing people, so there's a possibility that he might cough, there might be some blood. That's something we do see from time to time. It's very normal. We have medication that we give to make sure that people are sedated, that they're not feeling any discomfort from that. It takes a little while to work, but this is all very normal. When I'm in the room and something like that happens and the family member's there, I think the most important thing to do is to give them things to do. Give somebody something, even if it's just to distract them. There are things that we know are associated with comfort for patients. So, you know, you can get them a cup of ice water and a little towel and just say, hey, would you like to just mop his brow every now and again, put some cool water on his forehead or on his cheeks? We know that the studies show that that makes people feel more comfortable. Again, is it making this individual who's unconscious and unresponsive more comfortable? I have no idea. But I don't see any harm in it. And it gives this person something to do to feel like they're contributing to making their loved one feel more comfortable. When, you know, family members are watching, it can be hard to be, you know, sitting in a room watching somebody die slowly over a matter of hours or days. Say, hey, you got any photos, you got any pictures and stuff like that? Sometimes it's nice to just pass around the photos or show, play some music and stuff that he would like. And you create an environment, you give them purpose, to give them an action to do. And that can sort of distract a little bit and also give people a way that they can manifest their desire to support their loved one. I think that's probably very helpful. Obviously, there are more dramatic moments at the time of death that are harder to kind of, I won't say paper over, but to try to reassure people around. There are obviously moments when people die and they're not comfortable. And that's really sad when that happens. It's very hard, though, to guarantee that somebody's not going to suffer even a little bit at the time of their death. We're pretty good at it. I'd say most of the time we get it, and some of the times we don't.
Now, have you ever seen someone who came back, like had a cardiac arrest and was revived? Like, do they see the light?
I had some very spooky experiences as a fellow in the ICU. Individuals where I spent, you know, somebody who had a sudden event that was technically recoverable. So we kept going for some time on our fairly aggressive resuscitation that I probably would not have done in another context. But in this situation, because they had no underlying incurable condition or advanced chronic condition, that this was somebody who, you know, as long as we kept blood circulating and oxygen circulating, there was every reason to expect that we could bring them back. And I do remember a couple of situations where, you know, it gives me chills to remember this one. A younger man, he was paraplegic from a car accident many years ago, and he had a blood clot in his lung, a pulmonary embolus, and he arrested. We resuscitated him, but he was down for a long time. I was working on him for some hours. We got his heart beating again, but the oxygen level was really poor. And he was, you know, we had him deeply sedated and we were working really hard to kind of try to resolve the situation. It was a bit of a complicated thing, which I won't get into, but he stabilized, but it was after about 6 hours. But sure enough, he woke up and woke up pretty well. And then when I was talking to him a few days later, he said to me, he says, "Doc, you know, I remember you. You were in the room the whole time." He remembers himself, the whole event. He was essentially like a disembodied sort of head floating in the top corner of the room, looking down on the whole scene at himself being resuscitated by me and one of the other members of the team. And he remembers, he could recall like quite specific details of things that we had done, things that there's no way he should have known because of how sedated he was and the fact that he was unstable at the time, just had poor vitals and was on a breathing machine. That was very spooky to me because, again, I can't explain why he was able to know those things, but he did. I remember another person once where I had to go out to a community hospital and put them on extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, ECMO. It's essentially, in that case, it was a lung bypass, but sometimes used as a heart-lung bypass. Somebody with a very, very severe pneumonia that was going to need some time, and he was almost certainly going to die. We put him on ECMO and were able to get him stable and transferred him downtown, but it was a very big production to get there, and he nearly died multiple times as we tried to bring him downtown. And a week, 2 weeks or so later, he was awake and we were actually able to get him off of the ECMO and off of the breathing machine. And I got the breathing tube out of him and I asked him, I said, "Hey, do you recognize me?" And he said, "Oh yeah, I used to play Ultimate Frisbee with you." And I didn't remember him, but he was right. I had actually played Ultimate Frisbee with this guy. And it was like a game, a single game that we had played probably 10 years previously. And he remembered, and he had very vivid recollections of lots of things. And he told me a bit about his experience when he was super ill and had some bizarre stories that, things that just, it was odd because he clearly was more aware of what had been going on than I would have expected him to be given the situation, and stuff I can't explain.
Is Ultimate Frisbee still a thing?
I'm old. So this is an old story. I have no idea if Ultimate Frisbee is still a thing. I know that I throw Frisbees at my kids and they throw them back to me sometimes. That's what I know.
And so those stories are definitely very powerful. And I think the human experience and all of the unknowns about the work that we do and about life and death is certainly fascinating and draws me to my trade. But as we get towards the tail end of the interview, there is something that I need to touch on, and that's medical assistance in dying. Now, previously, I oversaw one of the largest programs in the country in medical assistance in dying. And what that meant is people asked me what that meant is I basically oversaw a team of clinicians who could go and do assessments and interventions, right? In Canada, this is something that our constitution and the federal government made something that was accessible to all Canadians, which is if some Canadians feel that their end is near and they want to choose the date that they die and have control over that, they can pursue a route of medical assistance in dying. And there's two steps of two different clinicians, doctors and nurse practitioners who do assessments to make sure that there's no secondary gain, you know, family members who are going to get rich off the will, to make sure that they're of clear mind as they make this decision. And that allows everybody these safeguards to make sure that if someone is pursuing this, they're not pursuing it for the right reasons, but they choose to die with dignity. And I oversaw the program in a binary fashion. question, which is, this is something that Canadians want and the government has authorized, and it's my duty to make sure that people have access to it. So I had a roster of clinicians who could do that. But obviously, it's an incredibly polarizing topic. You touched on the medical assistance in dying for people who have only a mental health condition, right? As of now in Canada, you need to have a physical ailment, right? A medical condition. You can't have severe depression and qualify. But that's something that's up in the news as to whether or not we will qualify. But it's a very polarizing topic, and a lot of people have different opinions about that. Do you ever see medical assistance in dying in Canada as something that all Canadians are cool with?
Well, I think, take a step back, Canadians as a whole have been pretty cool with MAID for a very long time. If you look at surveys going back to 5-6 decades, if I recall, I actually believe this is a subject that, since anyone has started surveying people on it, I believe a majority of Canadians were actually supportive of. And that goes back to, I think, the 70s and the 60s. But certainly more recently, the level of support in Canada is in the mid to high 80% range. The number opposed is in the single digits. So when you stop a bus and ask average Canadians, there's no question that there is an overwhelmingly large or high degree of support among Canadians. In certain groups that are maybe more outspoken on end-of-life issues, it's not as overwhelming. And I think those groups, the opinions are not necessarily representative of Canadians as a whole. Some people are opposed for religious reasons. Some people are opposed for, you know, moral reasons that are not religious in nature. Some people have had a long-standing historical opposition to it that they have not moved from. I would say, though, that, you know, within the medical field, and I think generationally you'll see this as well, that I think that individuals, there are many individuals who have changed their position on this over time. I think that most of us have seen the experience that we've had is that, you know, whether or not we agree with it or whether or not we'd use it, that it kind of seems to be just part of what everybody is doing now, and that there were problems that were forecast. Those problems have not come to pass. People are following the rules. And there are obviously controversial aspects of this that you've alluded to. But surveys routinely show that Canadians continue to support this, that, you know, the large majority very happy with the laws that we have. The ones who aren't happy are far more likely that the aspect of it they're not happy with is that it isn't broad enough. And of course, there are many jurisdictions in the world that have larger, more broad laws than we do, or eligibility than we do here in Canada. And that's not to say that we should follow their lead. We can obviously go our own way on any number of things. I think that what my interest is, because I was quite involved in the provision of MAID and policy development some years ago. I'm not involved in MAID provision for the past couple of years, but obviously have been managing a lot of people at or near the end of life who have been requesting MAID, quite up to date on the data and the reports. I think that what we need to do is, we now have a lot of data from many jurisdictions showing some clear patterns around, you know, who's getting assisted dying and why. I think we've started to understand that it is definitely something that is much more common among higher income, majority culture individuals, more highly educated individuals, far less likely among non-majority culture, far less likely among lower socioeconomic status individuals, lower education, all of these things. It is overwhelmingly common among people dying with terminal illnesses compared to non-terminal illnesses. So we've got, compared to organ failure and frailty. So we've got studies coming out and looking at data from around the world. And if you look at people with any given condition, what percentage of people with X condition who died by assisted death versus non-assisted death. And everywhere you go, the highest is ALS, below that is cancer, below that is non-cancer illnesses. And that the ratios between those three, although the absolute number of people who die by MAID changes around the world, the ratios between those three are remarkably well preserved everywhere you go. And so as you start to build a story, and again, like the concerns about, you know, service availability, service quality. Well, obviously there are problems with gaps in services and quality of services received. But I think we're pretty clear that those gaps aren't what's driving MAID, because the people who are getting MAID overwhelmingly are the people who seem to get the best palliative care and the best access to services or have the lowest needs. You're showing this quite routinely, and this is everywhere in the world. So I think we're coming to a much better understanding of who's getting MAID and why they're getting MAID. I think we still have a bit to learn about that. You know, people generally, I would say, as a stereotype, people with a high baseline and a rapid deterioration in their overall level of function condition, those are the people who tend to get MAID. It's not about how much support you need. It's not about sense of burdensomeness or anything else like that. All of these things seem to be equally common or less common among people who get made than it is among people who don't get made. And so I think that our obligation as healthcare providers, particularly end-of-life providers, aside from the question of, you know, the moral question of whether this is okay or not okay, which I think, you know, I think from a legal standpoint, that ship has sailed. But now it's our obligation to understand MAID and the practice of MAID better. And I think moving away from some of the older narratives around, the pejorative narratives around what previously we might have thought MAID to be about when it wasn't legal, now that it is legal and we have data, I think our understanding and our explanations must be more mature. And at the same time, I think we have to recognize where there are gaps, right? That, I mean, for me, seeing people coming to me asking that they wanted to end their own life and were perfectly competent individuals, highly supported individuals, you know, people with excellent access to services still wanting to end their life. And why? It's because, you know, again, they'd lost the ability to do things that gave their life meaning. These people with existential distress for which we really don't have a lot to offer. And that's a challenge. And for me, sort of been a pivot point to me, really trying to focus heavily now in this part of my career on identifying and evaluating new therapies or new approaches for how we address existential distress. And I think that whether that leads to fewer MAID cases, more MAID cases, that's less important to me than whether we're hopefully just being better able to address the suffering that people experience as they approach the end of life. That's our obligation.
So is that narrative that you see from the strong kind of anti-MAID or the people who have concerns with MAID, that this is something that predominantly people at the lower socioeconomic spectrum are doing to kind of escape the lack of secure housing and food, and something that people who don't have access to palliative care are doing? That's often the narrative that we see on that side. What do you say to those people as someone who knows all of the research and evidence around who's actually following through with this?
It's not that there's a little bit of evidence or that we don't know. We know very well who's getting MAID and why. We have a lot of data on this now. And some of it is subjective, but the objective data, like, you know, what illnesses they have and what services those groups have access to, completely inconsistent with the idea that poverty or lack of services or lack of housing is driving this to any substantial degree at all. If that were true, we would see completely different populations getting MAID than we do around the world. Now, I think we have to give the issue its fair understanding. Like, we know that poverty, marginal, like, you know, insecure housing, poor access to food, the affordability crisis, lack of affordable medications for managing chronic illnesses. I can give you an incredibly long list of all of the social factors and structural factors that are associated with shorter lifespan, with premature death. All of these things are associated with premature death. None of them are associated with MAID, right? So all of these factors are really important factors to understand because of how they drive mortality and how they end life and how they drive early mortality. But the moment you start talking about MAID in this context, you've lost the plot, because MAID is absolutely not the mechanism through which these social, socioeconomic, and structural factors cause premature death and suffering. If you took away MAID, you would prevent probably none of these individuals are actually requesting MAID for these reasons. People who are getting MAID are not getting it for these reasons at all. But the people with these issues are suffering tremendously and are still going to die. So I do kind of bristle sometimes when people talk about MAID in the context of a discussion around social deprivation, because it seems to me sometimes a cynical use of an important issue to drive a political agenda that is unrelated to this. I think that there are entirely different ways that we need to tackle the harms of insecure housing, insecure food, social deprivation. Things like the National Dental Care Plan is an excellent idea, you know, trying to build out comprehensive pharmaceutical coverage for everybody. Canada has excellent social programs for seniors in the sense that we have one of the lowest senior poverty rates in the world. We have almost no childhood poverty at all. It's pretty much all but disappeared statistically in the past 10 years. But we still do have tremendous gaps and high rates of poverty among the disabled and among other sort of groups in our population. So the coverage is not consistent. We need to make it consistent. And if people can't afford secure housing, that has horrible downstream effects. Like, housing is a crisis in this country and it needs to be addressed. Pretending that we can somehow protect people's lives or prevent them from dying, you know, through prohibiting MAID or setting limits on MAID, is to me just an outrageous misuse of the situation. And really, I think is unfortunately just is a very unfair way to distract from meaningful policy actions that can actually address the harms of these social problems.
Tell me how you really feel.
Well, I find it outrageous that we have these conversations, that people write editorials or come to committee meetings and talk about how much they care about the vulnerable, but not willing to, they don't have the single policy suggestion around, you know, universal basic income or, you know, food vouchers or, you know, housing vouchers or like not one formed thought around how we actually impact upon these issues and the harms that it causes to people. It's just grabbing onto a hot button issue and trying to pivot to use it to restrict access to MAID is just outrageous.
Totally. Now, wrapping up our conversation today, this has been amazing. I want to ask you, one of the things that we talked about earlier on is preparing for that end of life. And someone who does what you do, who supports patients and families at those terminal stages of life, to everybody listening today, what would you recommend that they do when they come home and they speak with their spouse, their partners, their families? What's one good thing to do if you're not actively dying or have a terminal disease, or even if you do, to be ready for that? What's one thing you should talk about?
Well, first thing, don't spend too long on it. The data around advanced care planning interventions and, you know, efforts to do this, they're not amazingly impressive in terms of the results, in terms of what they achieve. I think it's hard to have conversations like this absent context and understanding of what you actually are going to develop in terms of a condition as things advance. I think, first of all, if you do start to get a diagnosis of something or become aware that someone's health condition is starting to change, the conversation really just settles around, you know, what are some realistic things to expect down the line? Time frame of somebody's functional deterioration, the time frame of where somebody might expect to have an unforeseen event or a sudden event crop up. And what might that look like? You know, what type of crisis might arise? And again, in that context, who's going to be your decision maker? When your decision maker is put in a position of having to make a decision on your behalf, which is fairly common, you know, almost the majority of people will need a decision made on their behalf by a loved one at some point when they're unable to make a decision. And then what would be important? Like, are you at a point where maybe emphasizing quality of life is more important than emphasizing quantity of life? If that's true, then yeah, tell them that, work with your doctor. Like, I'd like simple, not particularly aggressive things done to keep me alive, but if those things don't work, keep me comfortable. Or, you know what, I'm having a great time and I want you to do as much as you can. Even if I didn't have this quality of life, I had a much worse quality of life, I would still value that and want that. I would like you to try to do what you can to help bring me back. If it's hopeless, that's fine. Just keep me comfortable and I'm okay with that. And most importantly, give your family members permission to use their best judgment. You never have perfect information. You never can be 100% certain about anything in life. And family members routinely say, when they're involved in substitute decision making, even for what might seem to physicians to be fairly clear and straightforward, you know, like, this really isn't even a decision. We're more or less just recognizing the fact that this is an incurable situation. People will feel guilty for months or years later, having felt like they were the ones, you know, who had to make that tough call. And make sure you give your family member permission to make a tough call. It's like, look, I trust you to make the decision. I know that you might decide to stop, you know, when it wasn't 100% certain that I wasn't going to come back. And that's okay. You know, because the world we live in is not one where there is ever 100% certainty around anything. You don't want them to feel torn up with guilt and frustration that you didn't manage to get every last minute out of someone's life that you might have. And I think that those are key points of any discussion, to make sure that, you know, who will be the person, that person knows that they're potentially going to be the ones to have to make a tough call, and that they'll have a team around them. They know the values, they know what kind of things they should be trying to achieve, and they know that they have permission to make a decision, even if they might ultimately be wrong. That's okay.
So thank you, Dr. James Downer. A little bit of homework there for everybody listening. Talk to your family members, share your value system with them, share what quality means to you, and empower them to make decisions on your behalf if ever you're on your deathbed and unable to do so. So thanks again for joining me in the studio today. I found that very informative and engaging.
Well, thanks a lot, Mark. It was a real pleasure to be on the podcast. And it was so much fun when you and I were working in the same hospital. And, you know, it's just nice to touch base again after all these years.
I love it. Thank you. What a fascinating episode. It's funny, I was reflecting on my career and training in medical school and how the starting of life, birth, is such an intense buildup and lead up to that delivery of the baby. But it happens so anticlimactically. A baby gets spit out, you cut the umbilical cord, you take out the placenta, and then a baby's there. And everyone kind of walks away and moves away from the room. Now, that's most births. Some births are obviously more complicated than that, require surgical delivery. Sometimes the babies aren't that healthy and require resuscitation when they come out. But for most people, it's a pretty quick, painful procedure, obviously, for the woman who's delivering the child. But once it's over, and there you go, there's a baby. Death is very different because most people have that fantasy of dying in their sleep and going to bed one night, waking up surrounded by loved ones, or not waking up, but your loved ones wake up and there you are dead, but he went peacefully in his sleep. And that's actually not what happens. I know in my career, I help and support a lot of patients as they are reaching the end of their life. And that may be a visit that I have with them in hospital 3 months before they pass away, perhaps where I break some bad news, or perhaps where I adjust some of their medications to help ease suffering and discomfort. Sometimes it's looking after people in the ICU environment or on the medical ward, where that end is near, that end is finite, and they're very close to it. And I help and support them as they get to that point. But by and large, that process is not as simple and quick as popping a baby out. It's slow, it's drawn out, it's emotional. It causes a lot of grief and struggling in the patients and the family members around them and requires a multi-pronged approach. Some of that advice that James Downer gave at the end about speaking with your family and loved ones is so important. There are so many times that I care for and look after people in the hospital environment who have never had that conversation with their friends or loved ones. And sometimes their spouses, their children are left struggling by the bedside, not quite sure what dad would have wanted when he was on his deathbed, and laden with guilt and abnormal emotions and feelings about those end-of-life care decisions. So for all of you who are listening to the episode today, make a point of talking about this with your loved ones, letting them know what you value. Do you love being outside completely independent? And if you can't have that, you wouldn't want to live? Or are you somebody who, as long as you can see people around you, maybe watch your favorite TV show, then that's something that you would like? Think about that. Have those conversations today, because they can make that end of life process a little bit easier on yourself and everyone around you. Hopefully everybody who listened in today learned a lot about what palliative care medicine is, what it isn't, what the history of palliative care medicine is, and how people actually die, and what that experience is like for patients, for their loved ones, and for the care providers who are part of that journey. Thanks again for listening into the episode. Thanks again to Dr. James Downer for taking the time out of his busy day to join us in the studio today and spit some wisdom. See you all next week on the flip side. Thanks for listening to Ditch the Lab Coat with Dr. Bonta, the home of science-based skepticism. Tune in next Wednesday for another healthcare conversation. For more information, please visit labcoat.fm.